The Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, Episode 17. New Brunswick is the only official bilingual province in Canada. Hello, travel nerds, and welcome to the Extra Pack of Peanuts Travel Podcast, the show that teaches you how to travel more while spending less. I'm Trav, the creator of Extra Pack of Peanuts, and with me today is a woman who has the unique career path of lawyer turned popular travel blogger, Jody Ettenberg of the aptly named LegalNomads.com and author of the Food Traveler's Handbook. Jody, thanks so much for coming on the show and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jody, I want to start off a little bit with your background because I find it so fascinating. How does one go from lawyering in New York City to becoming a full-time nomadic traveler?
Well, the plan was never to make this a new career. I never quit my job expecting or wanting to be a travel writer. It really happened extremely organically. And in my case, I had always wanted to travel. I saw a documentary on the Trans-Siberian trains when I was a kid. I found it really compelling. And over the years, having done smaller trips while as a lawyer and before, I really thought, you know, maybe I can do this for 1 year, travel around the world, go to Siberia and to Mongolia, see the things that were really exciting to me, and then return to New York and try and look for work in the legal field, but in the public sector outside of the private firm context, because I was working as a private lawyer, a corporate lawyer for the years that I was there. And just over the years, I started the site to keep my mother apprised of where I was going. It really wasn't, like I said, it wasn't supposed to be a career launch. And over the years, I just have gathered a following, and it seems to have gotten me to this place now, which I'm very grateful for, given how ad hoc it really was.
Yeah, that's great. So you envisioned 1 year you would kind of get traveling out of your system, you'd see the things you wanted to see, and then it was back to the real world, right?
That's right. I mean, I don't even know what the real world means, right? But sure. everyone makes whatever they want to make out of their life. And for me, that was doing more public sector work and advocacy, because while I learned a lot doing private sector work as a lawyer, I did M&A in securities, and then I moved into new media and technology law, and it was really interesting, but I just didn't feel very excited about the kind of work I was sort of leaving the world in a way, not in a legacy way, just I felt like I could be more useful than I was being. I will say my clients were great, and they've actually stayed in touch. When I had a book reading in New York, a lot of them came to it, which was really great. But generally speaking, I thought, you know, let's do something in the public sector, maybe something in microfinance, microcredit. But yeah, obviously not, because I'm talking to you somewhere not.
And I think that's interesting, because most of the people we've had on the show, travel doesn't start as this is going to be a job. Not many people jump into a thing, I'm going to be a travel blogger, travel writer, travel photographer, but they start traveling because they want to see the world, and all of a sudden they realize, well, now I can't go back. And it seems like that kind of thing happened to you then.
Well, there's no can't. I mean, you can do whatever you want. And I think if I decided I felt like staying in one place for a few years at a time, like, there's no shame in that, right? After 5.5 years of traveling, there's nothing to prove. It's not, I think the problem with the public facing blogging, the way many people do, is that your readers kind of take a world of their own, which is fabulous in many ways, but also I think contributes to people perhaps carrying on with blogging longer than they wanted to, because they end up feeling kind of beholden to their readership, which makes perfect sense. But ultimately, if you quit your job to travel because you thought it would bring you more joy, it's hard to say, I'm going to keep doing it, even though it doesn't bring me joy anymore, which I've sort of seen happen to some of my colleagues over the years. In my case, you know, I kept going because I was still fascinated by what I was doing, and I still am. You know, I'm really excited to get back to Asia. I'm currently in the States for the summer months. I tend to spend most of my winters in Asia and the summers speaking at conferences in the States and Canada, and generally just sort of having meetings with the journalists or the tech people that I work with tangentially during the course of the winter. So my routine is not what you would say a normal routine, but it's worked out so far. But as I said, there's no have to, you know, I'm always happy to move things around or to think about it a little differently. I think if you're building a life that's more flexible than what normally people are comfortable with, then you do owe it to yourself to make sure you keep your eyes open and see how it can be moved around if that works for you.
Yeah. And one of the really neat things you've done in this past year is write your book, The Food Traveler's Handbook. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. And you have your sights set on eating your way around the world, one country at a time, as your tagline kind of goes on your site. And that's something I can 100% get behind. Could you tell us a little bit about why you think food is such an important part of traveling?
Sure. I think food is important generally. I think a lot of people in North America are talking about food, but they're talking about it a lot more in a, you know, here's a trendy restaurant and I'm being hyper local. And there's nothing wrong with that because they're learning as well, but it's a different feel than the kind of cultural deep dive that I'm advocating. I'm not talking about food just because it's delicious to eat, but as a real lens to learn about a country. So if you head to, let's say, you know, Southeast Asia, and you pick three countries you want to explore in the course of your trip. Each of those foods have common links. Often there'll be a type of fish sauce involved that's fermented. There'll be a type of chili that's used. There'll be specific salads that are made. But each of the countries are very different, and that goes back to how their histories were formed, how they had been colonized or not over the years and things like that. So when I talk about food, I joke about it being, you know, getting your kids to eat broccoli kind of thing, where it's really pushing the idea of culture and history, but seeing it through the prism of this delicious meal that you eat, and using that as your tool to really connect to a local place.
Yeah. And I think that's the really interesting part about your book is you do give these actionable and kind of tips that people can follow, but you then dive a little deeper and talk about why food is so important, like you've just touched on. One of the things that you talk about in your book is how people can find food in other countries that is hygienic and won't make them sick. So what are some of the general tips that people should follow when they're in a new country and they're looking to discover local food?
Well, I should preface this by saying that the reason the book came about was my readers asking me to write something like this. They were like, we want to eat the way you eat. We're not sure how. And it was a perfect bridge to writing more about food because, you know, I wrote mostly about travel before. So it was kind of a natural extension, but it was fun that it came through my own readers who were like, please do this for
right,
us.
Right.
In terms of not getting sick, I mean, you will potentially get sick anyhow. There's no mitigating, you know, wholeheartedly against it. I've gotten sick over the years. I think most of people who've traveled long-term have.
Of course.
But there are certainly ways to try and avoid it. And one is, you know, looking around a country that you're at in terms of how they eat and their food patterns. You know, those of us who've been to Spain, they eat dinner quite late. In developing country, you want to try and time your meals around the time that locals are eating, not just because food stays and is like the turnover is quite fast, but because a lot of countries, at least the ones I've traveled to, do not have refrigeration that is what we're used
right.
to. And you don't want necessarily your food sitting out there all afternoon in the heat. You know, in places like Myanmar, if you're going to be eating curries, when the locals are eating the curries is when you want to eat them. So midday, usually for lunch, is the bigger meal, or, you know, early afternoon. And then in the evenings, try to get some of those street stacks instead that are kind of made on the spot instead of sitting in pots. Another thing I talk about in terms of fast turnover is to try and find universities in the towns you're in, because there's usually a really hungry bunch of students
very true.
Somewhere with, okay, maybe not the highest palate in terms of what gourmet food will be on offer, but it usually is a version of whatever's extremely comfortable and comfort food in the place. And it's very quick because students will eat and run back to class. So the turnover is usually very fast. It's usually somewhere you would not get sick. And it gives you a little bit of insight as well into sort of the local food tradition cultures that like mama's food that you can't get anymore because you're at school. So they're simple dishes, but they're often really fun to explore.
Yeah, that's a great, great suggestion. I've never even thought about that. And I know a lot of people want to try the local food when they go to a place, but they're scared to do it because they haven't been there before. And, you know, they don't want to ruin their vacation by getting sick. And as you said, there's no end all or be all cure for getting sick. It's probably going to happen at some point if you travel a lot. But you talk a lot about then eating at street carts, and I love to eat at street carts, especially when I'm in Southeast Asia where they're very abundant. What are the advice that you have for people who want to try these local foods but are scared to do it? How can they kind of take that first step?
I mean, the times I've gotten sick in those countries have been from restaurants, not okay. from street cart food. I mean, that's what's across the board, other travelers and friends who travel have said exactly the same. Oh, I got sick from this nice restaurant with tablecloths. Oh, I got sick from this tourist restaurant. I should have eaten on the street. I mean, it's a fallacy really that it's going to be less clean or less well prepared. If it's street food, it's kind of the opposite in many cases. And there are some countries that are different, you know, in parts of the subcontinent, like India, for example, you know, the bacteria and the exposure is very different than Southeast Asia. It's a very different feel. But if we're talking Southeast Asia specifically, I would say that your street food carts are actually the most hygienic option. Generally speaking, the food is turned over very fast. You can watch someone make it. You can see, are they touching the money? Are they touching money with their hands and then also touching raw food or cooked food? You probably don't want to go there. You have this ability for a kitchen that's right in front of you that restaurants don't afford you, and you don't know in those restaurants how long the food has been out there. If it's a crowded street food stall, I would say it's more safe in that case. For people who are scared, I think going to the morning markets is a good start. Probably Southeast Asia, South America are both areas where there's a ton of great morning markets, and they usually have food stalls attached because everyone's shopping and needs some food. And they are great places to just pick up a dish or pick up fried snacks or something just to kind of dip your foot into that concept. But in a context where people are legitimately shopping for their week or for their day, it means that there's a lot of people there and a lot of turnover. So the food tends to go very quickly and be fresh.
Yeah, and another perk about street carts or, you know, street food is that it's usually going to be your cheapest option. And a lot of people, when I talk to them about my time in Southeast Asia, don't believe me when I say that you can get a dollar or two dinner and stuff like that. So how about you? Can you verify that food is or can be that cheap in some of the developing countries?
Oh, sure. I mean, most of my meals are $1, $1.50. My budget for living in Vietnam was under $800 a month all in, including buses, trips, food, drink, everything, rent.
Wow.
And Vietnam rent is much more expensive than Thailand as well. I think, yes, food can be extremely cheap if you eat it on the street. The cost of living for things are different in many of those countries. The more expensive foods are going to be processed and not the vegetables and the meat and everything else. A local friend of mine was sort of appalled that North American groups that are traditionally poor were now fat. You know, the whole concept of obesity, they're saying, how is that possible? Because the poor people are the ones that are not fat because they're the ones, you know, with the ability to eat fruit and veg only. And I was like, actually, it's the opposite.
Right.
So in a lot of these countries, the processed foods are the expensive foods. There's no reason to get fried rice at a fancy tourist restaurant or in a tourist district. There are times for sure when some dishes are not on the street. You know, there's a beautiful soup in the south of Vietnam called Canh Chua. It is available on the street in some parts of the country, but generally if you want it elsewhere, it's going to be in a nicer restaurant. It's still going to cost you $2, but it's a nicer restaurant than street food because it takes time to prepare. And same in places like Morocco or in Jordan, where a lot of the street food is like the quick and easy grilled kebab, and they're beautiful, tagines, really good. But some of the really interesting spiced meals are not going to be available on the street. So if there's a culture of street food like Southeast Asia, you're down with your $1 meals. There are locals eating for lunch and dinner and everything else, and you're probably going to find most of what's available. So why pay for a less fresh, less delicious version in a restaurant?
Yeah, and some of the worst meals I've ever had when traveling were when I went to a Western-style restaurant. Like, I was in Thailand, and I thought, man, I just really want a burrito or something. And I'd go, and of course it was awful because you're in Thailand, you're getting a burrito. And, you know, the next day or later that day, I'd go and eat a $1 street food pad thai, and it was the best thing you've ever eaten. So not that you can't get Western food in other countries, but like you said, most of the time it's going to be a lot more expensive than local food, usually sure. absurdly so, and it's not going to be as fresh, and it's probably going to be pretty bad.
Well, I'm also... I will say that there are times when it's fun to have a treat. You know, even when I was living in Saigon and eating street food pretty much for every meal, there are some times when it's nice to go to a wine bar and grab a right. glass of wine, or it's nice to have a fancier dinner for some event. But if you're doing it because you're scared of the local food, I would really urge people to think about markets and street stalls, because there are some really great options. But more importantly than just the food is the fact that it's a window to how people eat. If you do have a local street food culture like you do in Vietnam, in Thailand, in parts of the world where people are running home from work and grabbing things on the street, you know, there's this ability to really watch the chaos in action. And that is itself almost a tourist attraction that you couldn't pay for otherwise, to see all the motorbikes kind of zooming in and out, and this sort of organized insanity of what happens on the street when people are eating and sitting with their families. I think that's really just priceless in terms of what it tells you about a culture and letting you observe it without being obnoxious.
Yeah, yeah, some of the most authentic experiences I've had when traveling have been from that, from eating around locals and being around locals and seeing how they interact while they're eating, because usually that's going to be the time where everyone's together. And so you really kind of get to see the family structure, the friend structure, and kind of how they go about their rituals. And it's a pretty neat experience, especially when you are sitting outside in one of these areas and there's just 1,000 people around all eating at once. It's really cool.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So we know now a little bit how to find safe food, but what about how to find the most delicious food? Because when I go to places, especially if I'm only there for a short time, I always get worried that I'm going to waste a meal, you know, going somewhere crappy or miss out on the most amazing restaurants. I'm going to come home and one of my friends will say, "You didn't go here? Like, how could you not go there? You got to go back." So how do you go about finding the most delicious food when traveling? What are kind of the tips and tricks you can give for that?
I think I have a significant advantage now, which is that my readers are as rabid about food as I am. And for example, I'm in San Francisco exploring for the first time. And I posted on my fan page that I was coming here, and I said, "Does anyone have, I'm celiac. I have celiac disease. So no gluten, but not to be trendy," which
right.
there's nothing wrong with that, but legitimately, like I will be really sick. And, I was like, "I need cheap eats that are gluten-free." And I think 70-something comments
wow.
of restaurants. And I made them all into a big spreadsheet. And I'm going to share it with my readers, obviously. They should all benefit from their respective helpfulness. So I have that going for me now, which is really fun. But before I had an instant food engine, I tended to look at blogs. I look at chowhound.com for general stuff. People give trip reports for countries that are less... Not the ones that are too off the beaten path, but for a lot of Europe, for a lot of North America, parts of Asia, Chowhound has a lot of really excited people about food, and will post they debate in the comments, just threads of people talking in that sense. There are some great food blogs out there, and often food blogs will have links or a blog list of other blogs they read about food. I don't tend to go to the ones that review restaurants per se. More the ones that care about culture. And so, you know, for example, Naomi Duguid, who writes about Burma and writes about Thailand, her insights into where to eat are indispensable. Eating Asia is a great site for looking at food in Asia. And she always tells the addresses of the places.
Very cool.
Sticky Rice is a great blog in northern Vietnam. So there are kind of this rabbit hole you can jump through. And that's a good starting point. From finding a place, often asking your taxi drivers, which is something that some people think doesn't work. It's worked for me
okay.
every time. I really, not to ask them where to eat, because they'll probably take you somewhere. They'll get commission
right, right.
to ask them where they ate lunch or breakfast. Where did you eat today? And they'll be surprised, but they'll usually tell you, and then they'll be excited that you want to
yeah.
know.
Yeah. And if you ask them the best place to eat, they'll, yeah, like you said, they'll take you to a restaurant that gets commission, then they'll probably take you like 6 jewelry stores and stuff like that.
Right.
So
Right. Yeah, you have to take them by surprise.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Very neat. And I know that you keep a pretty comprehensive list on your site of the resources that you use, and we'll link back to that in the show notes. Some of the things you listed and many, many more are on there. And I do agree that even just asking people you know have been there, like I've started putting stuff out to my readers now when I go somewhere, where should I eat, where should I drink? And I get a ton of different things. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to hit up a lot of those places, like in San Francisco. Someone told me, like three people told me to go to Ike Sandwiches, and I went there and it was awesome. So it's a really cool resource to use the people that you have. And if you don't have a blog or anything like that, of course you can just ask people you know who have gone to that country. And I always enjoy
Twitter. Take to social media. I mean, Twitter, you don't have to be, if you have like a specific city hashtag that's used or something like that, there are people who are in there who want you to love their city. People will be very excited to help you discover a place if they live there. And I found that to be the case all over the world, which is fun. You know, they have pride in where they're living and they want to make it better for you.
Yeah. And local recommendations are very rarely wrong, because these are the people who live there and have probably tried a bunch of stuff and they want to show you the best of the best. So yeah.
Hey.
Yep, Twitter's a great tool. And we ate at Brenda's in San Francisco, if you're interested. It's a Cajun place. That was recommended by a local there, and that was really good, too. So,
excellent. I will add it to the list.
Now, putting food aside for a second, what are some of the favorite places that you've been when you're traveling? What are places that you've really just come to enjoy and love and maybe even see as, you know, a second home, since now you are traveling full-time usually?
Yeah, I mean, I am traveling this fall specifically will be really crazy, but generally it's not really traveling full time. It's sort of like mini stints as an expat. I'll rent a place for 5 or 6 months at a time and then live there. So I did that in Thailand, in Chiang Mai, in Bangkok. I love Bangkok, and in Saigon most recently. I tend to stick to Southeast Asia, partly because of the cost of living, but also because as a celiac, it's a lot easier to find food that won't get me sick. I would love to go back and spend a ton of time in China. I was there for only about 6 weeks recently as 2008. But at this point, my body has gotten so sensitive that with all the soy sauce, which usually has wheat flour in it, I'm pretty much screwed. I would be really hard
bye-bye China.
To go back. I know. There's so many countries. Like, I'd love to spend time in Central Asia and go to Georgia, the country, and spend time in there's just so much great food to discover. But a lot of them are wheat heavy. So the places that are most comfortable for me in terms of exploring the culture and cultures that love food have tended to be parts of the Middle East in terms of food. Jordan and Morocco and North Africa have been really interesting. Not as comfortable as a solo female traveler, of course. Southeast Asia has really become a second home for me.
Very neat. Very neat. And you went from being a lawyer, presumably making decent money, to supporting yourself full time through your blog and now your book and some of the freelance writing and stuff you do with a bunch of different groups. One of the things that I like to focus on is helping people travel more while spending less so that they can continue to travel and not say, I'm going to take a 2-week trip, blow all my money, and then wait till next year, but getting to travel more and spending less while they're are in that country. I know you're a pretty frugal traveler yourself. So what are some of the most effective ways you save money when you're traveling?
I should start by going back for a second and saying I don't actually support myself through my blog. My blog is completely unmonetized with the exception of Amazon affiliate links for products that I use in the course of my travels. I've turned down all sponsorship and all ads, and I've been really adamant about that from day one. The ways that I support the work I do are through long-term partnerships with companies that I love and doing freelance writing work, doing social media consulting work. But I want to be clear about that because I think it's one of the things that my readers love. I get emails every week thanking me for not having ads on the site, which I'm glad is appreciated by the readers as well. In terms of being frugal, I mean, it's not a forced frugality so much as food is a huge cost spend for a lot of people. And when most of the dishes I would prefer to be eating are on the street, it's not like I'm sacrificing. It's what when I do have to go to a nicer restaurant for some party, I'm usually like, oh man, I really would rather be sitting on the street. I think that's part of it. I tend to, I'm really short and I'm a lightweight, so I don't drink very much as well. But renting a place for longer term, I think, is a great way to also save some money. It's a lot less expensive than a hostel usually, and it also affords you this ability to sort of dig in. So I tend to tell people that slow travel is really great in terms of both giving you the benefit of learning and also keeping your costs down. I don't do it because it's less expensive. I do it because I really want to dig under the surface at why food is what it is in a specific place. But I found it really has deepened my appreciation for a place as well. And so I tend to advocate doing that in the process. For those who stay in guest houses, obviously there are tons of boutique hostels that are popping up all over the place now that are not as expensive as hotels, but are also not your traditional 8-person dorm either. Right. And they're often beautiful. And even if it's a shared bathroom, it's usually a beautifully done bathroom, but there's tons of private rooms available that are very reasonable these days.
Yeah, and I'm a huge proponent of looking for those local guest houses, local boutique hostels, as opposed to kind of the big chain hotels. But for renting a place, one of the questions I have is, how do you find a place to rent when you get to a country? Do you do it before you go to a country? Do you spend a few days there? How has that worked out for the places that you've stayed kind of long term?
Generally, it's never a good idea to do it in advance. There are people who need the peace of mind, and I respect that. You know, they'll rent on Airbnb and or negotiate a deal or something like that. But it's usually much more expensive to do it that way. I just show up and then I pick a place that has food I like, and then I wander around that area and see if there's a sign for rent or. Usually, if you're standing on a street looking at a building, someone will walk up and be like, are you looking for an apartment?
Right.
The same applies for friends who've lived in Mexico for a few months or Asia or South America. It's whether you need to get a broker when you're there, that may be the case. It's usually only if you're trying to find a more luxury spot. But for every time I've rented an apartment in the last 4 years, I've honestly just wandered around and walked into buildings. And if they don't have a room, they'll usually tell you somewhere who does.
Yeah, very cool. And food is even helping making the decision of where you stay. So it all comes back to food then.
It all comes back to food.
And you mentioned being a female solo traveler. And if I could get your thoughts on that for just a few minutes, because that is a very unique situation and one that a lot of people are afraid to get into, but it's really starting to become a little more popular. People are seeing that they can do it. What are some of the disadvantages to it, and how have you dealt with like those obstacles of being a female solo traveler? And then kind of what are some of the advantages maybe?
Well, I think it's becoming more popular here, but it's been very, very popular in a lot of other places in the world, you know, in Scandinavia and in much of Europe and in Australia, New Zealand. Taking this gap year, whether you're solo or otherwise, female or otherwise, is not so surprising. In terms of North America and people starting to travel in this way now, I think, you know, for me, it never was an obstacle in my mind. What it is obviously something that requires me to think more strategically about some of the things I do. A lot of the tips I give are tips that would apply to both genders, though. I don't brand myself as a solo female traveler because I don't know that there are that many tips that would even be specific to women. You know, dressing conservatively is very important, obviously, in countries that are more conservative and will get you more respect from locals in the process. But there are certain countries where even dressing conservatively is not going to help you. And that's a very personal decision to decide whether you want to go there and how to mitigate against it. I'm very rarely completely alone in that it's very easy to meet people at guest houses and at hostels. And friends will connect me with friends that are expats in countries and that kind of thing. And that's not limited to me as a travel blogger. I think it's very easy in that case if you reach out to friends. There's often a network somewhere. But what I would say is that, you know, picking hostels that are or guest houses that are very central in well-lit parts, never tell people where you're staying if they are asking you. I usually tend to just make something up and never give the real answer. And, you know, being very cognizant of where you're going at night. The reality is, as a woman, bad things happen at home and they happen abroad. Right. And it's very frustrating to see a lot of the dialogue around women traveling alone, especially when Sarah Sierra was killed in Turkey. There was all this kind of vomiting around the internet about how women should stay home and not travel alone. And then the news about those women in Cleveland came out. I mean, it's not limited to abroad at all. And the dialogue, I wish, was focused more on why these things tend to happen to women everywhere.
Right, in general, yeah.
not just in travel, right? For those who are interested, I do have a post. I wrote one post about this because I was so frustrated with the media skew. And it's on my site, basically called Revisiting the Solo Female Travel Experience. And at the end, I give a whole bunch of tips for both men and women on traveling alone.
Yeah. And like you said, I do think that when you are traveling, you are very rarely alone if you make an effort to meet other people. And if you're in parts of the world that are at least somewhat, you know, densely populated and stuff like that, you're not really going to be alone, and you can meet people and they can become like old friends very quickly, especially when you're traveling, because those bonds happen pretty quick.
Sure.
The million-dollar question that I've been waiting to ask, and the listeners should probably get their notepads out and start scribbling this down, is where are a few of the very best places that you've ever eaten?
No one's ever asked me that, to be honest.
Really? Well, first time, right?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to. There's places I love in every city I go. If I constantly post where I have places I love because of that, but things change so fast. Okay. Like a street stall I love, next week she might have moved her cart somewhere else. Like you just don't. It's very hard to give answers like that. For restaurants specifically, my friend Jarrett Risley has a restaurant in Bangkok called Soul Food, and it's on Soi 55, and it's more expensive than your street stall, but it's fabulous food. He's so good at putting together different flavors from Southeast Asia. He won't use MSG, not because he thinks it's bad for you, but because he's like, it's cheating. It makes things taste better than they really do. And his food is spectacular. He has a duck, like a poached duck egg lob that is fabulous, and some really great curries. In New York, I have a whole bunch of recommendations I just put up on my site, okay. All of which are not specifically gluten-free restaurants, just they have options for celiacs as well. And I tend to, in every city there's something, but I don't think there's a place I would say this is the best place I ate.
Okay. What about your favorite? Is there a favorite city you have for food, or have they all just been so good that you couldn't even pick that?
Yeah, I think every city has a million different levels of, you know, how you can find your food. And there's always going to be something spectacular. Even in a country like the Philippines, where people tell me, I can't believe you spent 4 months there because the food's so terrible. I mean, yeah, there's no question that they don't spice foods the way that the rest of the region does. But there's these amazing, you know, jackfruit coconut dishes and roast pig and grilled squids. There's always great food everywhere. I think too much of our society is focused on like top 10 lists and the very best of X, Y, and Z. But the reality is, even in crowded touristy places, you can find spectacular food if you just look a little harder.
Yeah. And if you are spending a decent amount of time in a place like you tend to do, then you're probably going to end up finding a few hidden gems just because you have the time to go out and search and look and ask people, as opposed to if you're there for a week, you know, you're eating and doing so many other stuff, you might not have time to do that. So.
Right.
Well, Jody, thanks for joining us. What do you have coming up that people should be looking out for?
Well, this fall, I'm taking my mother to India. She is not a traveler.
All right.
She loves to read everything, and she has traveled, but she's not a traveler. This is not why I travel. People expect my parents to be like roving journalists, and I was like, no. So I promised I would take her to see the Taj for her birthday. It's very exciting. We're going together. And then after that, I'm going to go back to Vietnam in the new year. I'm starting up food tours, which I'm really excited about, in the same vein that my readers were asking me to write a book for them. They've asked me, can we pay you to feed us? And
sure.
I said, why, yes. So they're not destination. It's not going to be like Vietnam food tours or anything like that. It's just wherever I am at the time, having these meetups where people, I can take people, talk about the history of the foods in that place. So essentially it won't be locked into one destination, but wherever I am at the time. So I'm very excited to start in Vietnam because I miss Vietnam a lot. So I'm really thrilled to get back there and to share some of the knowledge I've accrued over the years.
Yeah, that's a very cool idea. If we get to Vietnam, we'll have to make sure we can get on one of your little food tours, if they're not sold out, of course.
Well, they're going to be very, there'll be about six people at each maximum. I won't do very big tours specifically, because it's much more fun to have a small group, especially if you're going to markets and things like that. So it'll be very tiny, and I'm sure we can make room for you guys regardless.
That'll be great. Jody, thanks so much for coming on the show. Your book is an amazing resource for the food loving traveler like myself, and your website, in my mind, is a must read for any type of traveler, because you just give tons of great information. Like you said, it's ad free. People can read it without having to see a bunch of things blinking around, and we really appreciate that. Before I let you go, can you just remind people one more time how they can come find you and connect with you on the internet?
Sure. I'm at legalnomads.com, and as well, same on Facebook and Twitter. It's just facebook.com/legalnomads, and same on the Twitter, which I use a lot for astronomy and technology and nerdy stuff, and not much about travel on Twitter. The site itself is the best way to get in touch with me. There's a contact form there, but people can just email to jody@legalnomads.com.
Okay, and the book can be found on your site, and then also people can find it on Amazon, correct?
Right. It's called The Food Traveler's Handbook, and it can be – I have a food page with resources on the site as well, and it's available just searching on Amazon or looking under my name, which is Jody Edinburgh.
Great. Jody, once again, thanks so much for coming on the show. I can't wait to maybe see you in Vietnam for that food tour.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you're like me, then you know that there is nothing better when traveling than experiencing new, awesome food. And Jody is the person to help you really dig in to food when you're traveling. You like that little pun there, huh? Check out her new book, The Food Traveler's Handbook, which has gotten fantastic reviews already. And make sure you follow her over at legalnomads.com. She's got years of amazing stuff written there. Thanks for tuning in to yet another episode of the Extra Pack of Peanuts podcast. And until next time, happy free travels. Don't have to worry.